The Art of Leadership Network.
I would say, yeah, spend some time having a good vision for your church. It's important. There's plenty of great tools out there. But vision is not the only thing. And in fact, I would say strategy is actually more important than vision in a lot of churches today.
Welcome to Leaders in Living Rooms. I'm your host, Sean Morgan, bringing you access and insights to leaders and their stories. Hey, leaders, we're kicking this one off with best-selling author Tom Rainer and his son, Sam, from churchanswers.com. Did you know pastors overestimate the effect of vision casting and underestimate the effects of management and operations in their church? We talk about that and many other great topics. We have a great shift toward the effect of evangelism. And of course, physical attendance still needs to remain number one in your church metrics. Hugely important. We dive into that episode here momentarily. A huge thanks to Food for the Hungry. FH.org is their website. If your church is looking for a missional partner, I would recommend Food for the Hungry. FH.org/churches is their church partnership website. I just got back from a trip to Guatemala with Food for the Hungry that was highly impactful. Our previous episode hit some of the highlights of that trip. And here we go, diving into this episode with Tom and Sam Rainer. Hey, podcasters, welcome back to this episode with Tom and Sam Rainer. We're privileged to have them on. They have been involved in so many different forms of church leadership. We're going to talk a little bit about Sam's new book, Neighborhood Church Focused Book and Ministry. But Tom, you're very well versed in lots of different things, including I read something like double digits in terms of interim pastor work. Is that right?
Yes, I went through a season of that in 10 or 11 churches back to back to back to back to back. So yes, I went through a long season of that. And on top of that, at Church Answers, we're actually certifying interim pastors. So we're working with people who are actually going in the world of interim pastors. So we get a heads up on both of those.
So I would love to talk about that. We've done a couple of years now of transitions leadership with this podcast, and I don't think we've ever done an episode with people who have been really called as interim leaders in the church. And I think transitions arguably are one of the most important seasons for the church to get well. And I've actually had the privilege of being in a seat and seeing a lot of transitions go well. But unfortunately, when I talk to other people, they don't seem to have the same opinion. A lot of people talk about transitions with a frown on their face. So I would love to have just some of your insights on, and it can be from both of you, from Sam, from your leadership and your work coaching and consulting. But what are you seeing in the landscape of church transitions? And that can be what you're seeing from your position now, or it could be, Tom, from any of your years being in the seat as a transitions leader, which is an incredible. I've never had anybody who's done that many transitions.
Well, Sean, let's do it this way. For this particular question, I want Sam to provide some of the data points, particularly related to the baby boomers and the number of people who are going into some type of transition from that age viewpoint, particularly interim pastors or things that they will be doing or already are doing. I think it'll help your audience if we first just give the stark reality of the pool of people who might do this. And then I'll follow Sam and I'll talk about some of my on-the-ground experience with many, many interim pastorates in the past. So Sam, I shouldn't be interviewing you, Sam, but I'm going to do this anyway. Talk about some of the demographics to give us some background.
Yeah, I mean, demographically, the big picture here is that the median age of a pastor is getting much older. You know, you're looking at, you know, a typical pastor today is 58, 59, 60 years old. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a 60, 65, 70-year-old pastor. There are plenty of people that age who can do the job and do it well. The issue is that age keeps creeping up, and it's a median. So what that means is that there aren't enough younger pastors to take the place of these older pastors. So the problem is not the age. The problem is that we just don't have a lot of younger pastors. So what this means for churches and transitions is there's going to be a lot of baby boomer pastors who become interim pastors. And I think a lot of churches are going to enter into a cycle of longer interims because they won't be able to find the pastors that they need.
Okay, so they're responding to a need. They're looking for a younger pastor that they can probably get a decade and a half or multiple decades in like consistent, stable leadership. They can't find it, so they're responding with an increase of, well, this is sort of a stopgap, an intentional interim. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think so. Now, you make it sound so strategic. I don't know that many churches think that way. But yeah, I think you're going to see more interim roles or transitional roles, and those roles become longer as the supply of younger pastors gets smaller.
We have just entered into a relationship with a denomination. I don't know if I have permission to release the name of the denomination at this point, so I will not, where we will be providing training and certification for their interim pastors in that denomination. They see such a big need that is there that they say, we are going to be strategic about transitions. We're going to be strategic about as the baton is passed from one pastor to another, or it is passed from one pastor to a mediator to another. And ultimately, that in-between person is going to be critical for the passing of the baton. And you did note, Sean, that I had done several interim pastorates in the past. There are basically two categories of interim pastors, if you can just simplify this. One is to be an interim pastor, where that person is truly fulfilling the role of all the pastoral roles, usually there on the field, someone who can live there, at least spend significant time in the community. And those used to be rare, but they were still present. The other is the interim pastor that primarily has a preaching and consultative role. Those have been more common. I never did an interim pastorate where I moved to the field. So I provided preaching and I provided strategy and sometimes some staff leadership as well. But again, it was limited. I saw my role in three basic buckets during this time. One was to provide hope. That church that is going through an interim has lost a pastor, and either they're happy about it or they're sad about it. In either case, it is a transition issue. If they're happy about it, then they've gone through some type of difficult exit where there was some kind of problem. If they're sad about it, they're going through grief and they have to deal with that. So one of the roles that I always had as an interim pastor was, let's see what the Bible says about hope. Let's talk about future in a very positive way. So that was one of those. Another bucket that I did, and I alluded to this just a minute ago, was I provided some consultative services. They would ask questions about should we, could we, and sometimes depending upon the polity of the church, whether it had a search committee or an elder-led board to find the pastor, I would have a direct relationship with them, not to find a person, but to help them with process and with key issues. So first role was providing hope. The second role was being there in a consultative role. The third was to make the tough decisions and act upon them during the interim. The more that I could do of that, particularly if they were people related, but even if it was structural or program or ministry related, the more I could do for that, the easier and more hopeful the transition would be for the incoming after the interim period was over. So I focused upon those three areas, and it seemed to go pretty well. Looking back at the transition and the baton handing off, I don't know how responsible I was for those who had successes after I stepped down, but I can say for most of them, when the next pastor came along, it was a pretty positive situation.
Tom, when you talk about tough decisions, and I'm just, what's below that? Was there something, the tough decision had to be made to make a change? Was there something common? Let's just start there, because I think there's two levels of questions around this. The first one would be, were there common things you ran into, commonalities?
Yeah, the most commonality was that it was related to a person. It was personnel related, but closely related to the fact that it was personnel related, the church had gotten into the bad performance and habit of kicking the can, and they knew that they had to make a decision, but they thought if they just waited, something would happen, something that everyone knew would not happen, but they just said, maybe if we wait a while, this will just work itself out. Well, the theological response to that is baloney. It did not. And so I would often go and make the tough call. I would speak to the people that would be on the receiving end of this. That was the most common.
Okay. So are you talking about moving somebody on, like a paid staff member who needs to be moved on, or a lay leader? Or are you talking about fiefdoms, like, you know, don't move my cheese kind of issues?
Yes, to all of them, but the ones that I was specifically referring to were related to staff and staff positions more than lay and lay positions. Mm-hmm. Basically, it goes back to Collins, and you got people on the bus, and you can do one of two things with them. If it's not working, you can move them to another seat on the bus, or you can say that they are not to be on the bus anymore. Right. So the bus decisions were the ones that I was were primarily involved in.
So I've worked with, you know, a few hundred churches in transition now, mostly with incoming leaders who would have been in similar situations to you as an interim and incoming leader. The ones that I've worked with haven't had a planned end date or a planned interim label to their leadership, although some of them proved to be interim positions, as we would know. So in all those cases, I would say probably 100%, they inherit staff and some staff who are not contributing to the mission. In fact, maybe, you know, I think there's a metaphor of like, if you're in a canoe, like a multi-person canoe, you have people who are pulling, like they're moving the boat forward. You have people who are rowing, but they're not really pulling hard. And then you have people whose paddle's in the water and they're actually providing drag. They're actually making the boat a little slower. And every situation, they've inherited people like that. So what's beneath the surface of that in the culture of organizations, and particularly the culture of local churches, where we pay people that don't help us move the mission forward? Isn't the mission too important for that?
Sam has so much on-the-ground experience in this area that I will yield the floor to the younger Rainer.
Yeah, I mean, people can be a drag, certainly. You know, there's a calculus to, you know, who needs to go and how much you can, you know, how much resistance you can, you know, withstand. In my case, you know, if we're talking paid staff, I've encountered all sorts of situations from, you know, horrific moral failures that the church had just overlooked, they were still on staff, to people who had, you know, very specific agendas, and any sort of movement against that agenda, that they had their constituency ready to go to fight you. Got it. And then, of course, you know, I've worked with, you know, I've pastored a few churches and worked with many others in a consulting role. You know, I'd say the bulk of staff, generally paid staff, are ready and willing to move. They're ready and willing to do what they need to do. But a lot of churches, unfortunately, have staff structures that, even though the staff are excited and willing to do whatever, the structure itself holds the church back. So I would say, if you're in a transition role, if you're the person who's leading this effort, if you're, you know, the pastor or on the board of elders or something like that, I would say, okay, you need to properly analyze what's going on. Do you have somebody who's a drag because they're just morally not where they need to be, or do they have a personal agenda, or could they work much better if we restructured? And I think in most cases, the ones I've encountered, the structure itself is the problem. I mean, churches have good people for the most part. Any one staff, you could probably find somebody that's not pulling their weight. But part of what I've done in, you know, consulting role is to help churches see the value of rethinking kind of how they do their staff structures.
Tom, anything to add on that?
Well, I will say this. Sam is exactly right on the staff structure, but Sam has also been one that has inherited the other type. And I have watched him, I'm speaking for him now, but I have watched him make really one of three decisions. One, this is urgent. It has to be dealt with. We have no choice. And that's usually the clear moral failure that is mm-hmm. turned the church topsy-turvy. The other one is, okay, if it's a turf term issue or if it's a philosophical mismatch or that, is there the possibility of change? And I've watched him deal with that issue as well. And basically, he's trying to make the decision, which way do I go? And he said all of these in his churches that where he has served as pastor. And now I'm looking from the outside. And the third one is, you know, it's not perfect, but we can live with this, all things considered. Because the reality of it is none of our staff are perfect. None of us are perfect. And so he lives with the situation. Sometimes he said, I wish it would change, but all things considered, it is better just to say we're in a good position right now rather than causing conflict for what may be, it's a choosing your battle type of thing, I guess to say. So I wanted to speak for him. I know that he was being gracious and talking about most of them are in structural situations that can change, but he has had to deal with the bus issue, mm-hmm. wrong seat, wrong bus. So he has dealt with that too. So that's my addition to it. And I don't need to speak for my son too much because he could have done it himself.
That's awesome. I think I would say some of the heavier mantles that transitions leaders have carried that I've seen have been in situations where for either whether they put it on themselves or the culture in the church was that part of the success of the transition is that everybody who's here remains here over the years through the transition, which is really weird for me to think about because if you know change management and the adoption curve in general, not everybody gets on board. And so you've got members of the church that everybody thinks, well, we're only going to succeed if as we move the church forward, if all these people stay a part of this church and that you lead with the staff that you inherit. And I see leaders 3, 4, 5 years after the baton pass carrying that mantle of trying to bring about change with old models of thinking and older people, not necessarily old in age, but tenured in the organization. They've become the establishment, maybe fighting for the wrong things, not really fighting for mission with change, but fighting for method. So as we think about moving staff on or having those tough conversations, I'd be curious what insight you both have, whether it was as lead pastor roles or interim lead pastor roles, on beginning to help the church focus on the mission over the method in a change management transitions period.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking change theory. I mean, there's several approaches to how you can lead a church during a transition. One, if you are an interim pastor, you obviously need to be very careful about making permanent changes because you're not going to be the one that sees them through. So let's just, you know, take two steps back. And there will be some obvious things that need to be done. If your church is not cash flowing every week because of personnel costs that are too high, well, guess what? You may have to take full-time people and make them part-time. If you've got a particular program that you think needs to change, well, you don't know that maybe the next pastor likes that program or believes in it. So there are certain things that I think that are urgent that an interim pastor should do. I think there's other things that there's only with great wisdom should you change. Now, if you're the person who's going to be there presumably long term, you know, you have to weigh the calculus of the people that are there. You're right. Rare would be a case where, hey, we're going to move this church forward. It's going to get revitalized. Things are going to change. We're going to do God's mission, and everyone that started with me is going to stay. That would be an extraordinarily rare case. People will, and part of the problem is people will project on you as the new person. They don't know you. They don't know anything about you for the most part. But they will project the things that they like on you, assuming that you're that person, or the things they don't like. And so from day one, you've got this, okay, I remember my pastor from 30 years ago. I really liked him. He preached this certain way or did these certain things. And so I'm just assuming this new person is that or is not that. And so you're constantly dealing with educating people of who you really are, and while at the same time making the needed changes. And one way to end the honeymoon rather quickly is to change something that people didn't want to change, right? So, and it may even be necessary. I would say in a couple of things here, in most cases, one, you're in today's church, like as of today, there are less preference-driven churches now than prior to the pandemic because we lost a lot of the cultural Christians. So the core that's remaining tend to be the ones that are ready and willing. So yeah, churches are smaller, but that core is stronger. And so I would say if you have the stability, the financial stability to do so, a lot of times gradualism is a good way to go because you don't have to rock the boat. The core's there. As long as you educate them, as long as they can, you know, get to know you over a couple of years and begin to trust you. People may respect you day one. They don't necessarily trust you day one. So as long as you can build that trust and enact gradual change, if you have that luxury, then that's a good way to go because the core that's there, though they might not be, you know, as flexible as you like, I think a lot of churches do have more flexibility today than, say, 5 years ago.
I agree. And when we look at probably the most pervasive principle that we teach, particularly new leaders, but those who are looking to establish their leadership, the incoming, as we would say here, Sam and I talk about the berry bucket theory just quite often. And you got the old berries and the new berries. And who are the old berries? The old berries are those who were there when the new guy came in. Who are the new berries? Everybody else. Well, the new berry bucket is most likely going to get bigger, the old berry, or heavier, let's say, for the metaphor. And the old berry bucket cannot do anything but get lighter. It transfers in death, moving, and all of that. And by the time the berry buckets are almost in balance with each other, you can anticipate conflict because the old berries are beginning to see that change is coming. Those other people have a greater voice. But you can also enact change better because you have more of the berries, the bucket berries on your perspective, your side, than otherwise. So it goes right along with what Sam is saying. Sometimes you have the luxury to wait. Sometimes you don't. The berry bucket may help you determine when and if.
Love that metaphor. It's sort of in line with John Cotter's Leading Change, Guiding Coalition. You know, when you have a group of people that have influence to help you make the changes, provide support for the changes. And I think in that metaphor, you're really talking about just the weight of the Newberry bucket.
By the way, that came from your state, not Northern California where you are, but it did come from Fuller. And a guy by the name of Carl George was the originator of the phrase berry bucket. So I want to give credit where credit is due.
Okay. Good. Well, when I reuse it, I'm sure I'll reuse that one a lot, probably even this week. Now I know. So pastors, I say wear hats in two different areas, like it's manager, leader, pastor, shepherd. And Brady Boyd tells some great stories of inheriting New Life Church after Ted Haggard's fall and being on the cover of magazines and, you know, pretty much every news article for a while. And then 100 days into his leadership, a gunman comes on campus and actually kills people. And he says he really was in a season of just needing to pastor and shepherd a hurting congregation. Other congregations are obviously in very different places. How does a new leader, incoming leader, know which hat to wear and for how long?
Well, I would say that pastors tend to overestimate the value of vision and underestimate the value of strategy. So you mentioned that age-old paradigm of leader and manager. I'll just say this. If you're not willing to manage, you're not fit to lead. So if you think that you can be just a leader and not a manager in the church, you need to find another job. Because much of pastoring, even at some of the biggest churches, where lead pastors are far removed from some of the day-to-day managerial decisions, even in those cases, you're dealing with a lot of management. So I'll just caution anyone who wants to dismiss management principles. I think that we need to be utilizing them more. And I really think vision has been overdone. Vision's important, don't get me wrong. Please have a good vision for your church. But vision is just what's beyond the horizon. It's worthless if you can't get there, and strategy is the pathway to get there. And the only way that you're going to accomplish a strategy is to have good tactics, which are the steps along the pathway. And that's operations. That's management. So churches tend to do day-to-day and week-to-week operations well. I mean, services still happen. Child check-in still occurs. You know, the choir's still in the loft every week. Those are operations and management issues. But what is often missed is how can we make those steps move us forward towards the vision? And that's what strategy does. It's that pathway to the vision. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah, spend some time having a good vision for your church. It's important. There's plenty of great tools out there. But vision is not the only thing. And in fact, I would say strategy is actually more important than vision in a lot of churches today.
Eric Geiger and I wrote a book several years ago called Simple Church. And the essence of it was, is your strategy, is your vision. And it was process-driven discipleship, which is the strategy. And so you didn't come up with a vision and then try to make the strategy work. You said, this is the process of discipleship, and now we're going to name it according to the process. So I'm echoing what Sam is saying through the theme of another book that I wrote, this one with Eric Geiger, who is in your state as well.
Yeah, he's at Mariners.
That's right. Well, we always say on the West Coast, the rest of the United States is 5 to 10 years behind us. But no, that isn't true at all. I just ribbing you a little bit. But I do have a question for you. Tom, the other role for an interim pastor is not to inherit the church and lead it on the front end, but it's also to prepare it for a new leader. And Sam, like you said, the median age is somewhere between 58 and 60-ish right now. That's all, you know, 6 months old or a year old data. So we don't know exactly where that number is, but it's been trending from 55 towards 60 over the last few years for sure. So there's a lot of leaders thinking about their final few years, whether they're an interim getting ready to pass it off or a retiring leader. What are things that leaders that would consider themselves over the next few years, outgoing leaders, what are things they could be doing well to prepare the church for transition?
Defining reality would be one of the key issues. And it would be good for the interim pastor or the transitioning out pastor, whichever one that person may be, but defining reality. Sam and I have been doing consultations for quite a while because I'm older. I've done a lot more than he has. And one of the greatest challenges we have in any church is, hey, this is what's really going on. And sometimes that even is with the pastor. But one of the greatest things a pastor can do, if that pastor knows the transition's about to happen, is let's define reality. Let's define reality for our church. Let's define reality about our community. Let's set expectations and define reality. Let's look at where we really are instead of living in this world that we think think we are. Sam and I have a great example from a consultation we did a few years ago. We were interviewing different lay people, and the church size had been cut in half over a 15 to 20 year period. The details aren't important. And this lady had been there for the whole time. And we just simply asked her, why do you think the church has declined so much? And her response, why, Sam?
Well, they thought it was the new young pastor. He was the problem.
Yeah.
But the decline started, it was 30 years prior.
Yeah. Wow.
So yeah. He was in his 20s. And we had to tell her that, hey, your problem's older than your pastor, all right? And they didn't believe the numbers. We showed them the numbers and they said, we don't think these numbers are correct. And we had to inform them, these are the numbers you gave us. We just put them in a chart and drew it out. So yeah, a lot of churches are in denial, and waking them up to the realities of their condition is important. But I'll just add, Dad, I think one of the biggest issues in just about any size church anywhere is the lack of evangelism. I mean, we see this all the time. What's the biggest issue in the church today? You know, we get asked that question a lot. And I would just say, churches don't do evangelism. And it's well documented that most growing churches, the vast majority of growing churches, it's because of transfer growth. And, you know, that's been the case for 15, 20, 30 years. And, you know, it's disheartening. It's troubling. And, you know, it's time for the church to wake up to the reality of, hey, we need to do the work of the Great Commission, the Acts 1-8 imperative. We've got to do the work of evangelism.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the Barry buckets. Is the old Barry bucket will only get lighter. The only way to grow a church is to reach people who aren't coming here. And hopefully that's not transfer growth. There's a caveat there.
Transfer growth is going to be available less and less because cultural Christianity is dead. There will be some who will move to your town from another church, but Sam defines transfer growth as transfer from church to church within a community. So that number is going to come less and less. The people who went from the what's happening now church to it's not happening now, I'm going to go to another church, that cultural Christianity group is about gone in most communities.
So what does that look like when you see a lack of focus on evangelism? Give us some real tangible things. And what does it look like when you see a church renewing a focus on evangelism? Any practical things that you could say? Because I think when you talk about church decline, people assume you're talking about attendance. When you talk about church growth, people assume you're talking about attendance. But I'm actually hearing a lot of churches, large churches, 30,000, 40,000 in weekly attendance that don't measure attendance anymore. They measure discipleship growth. They measure movement in the things that are measurable. Obviously, there's not a lot that is. So what are the practical things that tell you a church has a decay or decline in evangelism? And what are the practical things that you see really a renewed focus?
I'll just say, if you claim to be a church of 30,000 and you're not tracking attendance, you're not really a church of 30,000. That's what's going on in some of the largest churches. Is the reason they're not reporting their numbers is because their numbers are way, way, way down. So you know, let's just get that out of the way first. You know, I do think it's important to track your attendance. I think it's important to follow the metrics, and one of the metrics of success, probably the top metric of success, is attendance and attendance growth. That's just a fact. You can bemoan that fact, but it's a fact. I think that there are obviously better metrics to follow. And the one that I like to follow is the conversion ratio. How many people in my church does it take to win one person to Christ? And anything under 20 is good. So if you are a church of 200 in attendance and you had 20 people come to Christ through the ministry of your church, your conversion ratio is 10 to 1. 10 people, it took 10 people to win one person to Christ in a given year. So that's how the conversion ratio works. So this is a good way to, whether you're a large church or a small church, to figure out, okay, are we healthy? Because it's basically per capita. It's a measurement that takes out, you know, the largeness factor. So whether you're a church of 50 or 5,000, the conversion ratio is a really good way to determine, are we doing evangelism or not? And I'll say that it's probably a better ratio to track than just raw attendance, although you can't do your conversion ratio without tracking raw attendance. So yeah, please track your attendance and stop including your digital viewers as well. I'll just get on a little bit of a soapbox here. There's a lot of inflation going on out there, and the digital viewers are one way that's happening. But conversion ratios, where I would start in terms of how do we know that that's a good place to start.
There's all of these false dichotomies that are present right now. One of them is it's not about how many are attending, it's how many we are sending. That's really putting at odds with each other. The mandate to gather, the mandate to not forget, forsake assembling, with sending people out as evangelists or Great Commission persons. So there's all the, another one is the church is not the building, it's the people. This is true that the church is the people of God, but that is again a false dichotomy, because the church is also gathering someplace. And most places it's going to be a building, some places it may be under a tree or some other place, but the point is there is a point of gathering. So you're having these false dichotomies that are present to try to minimize the importance of attendance. And the reality of it is it's hard to evaluate the effectiveness of a church unless you know how many people are regularly gathering. So, but I was going to talk about the Hope Initiative. We looked at churches for a year. We actually did beta tests. And we sent them through a 30-day process, simple as it can be. Get a group in your church to do something for every day for 30 days. Usually it takes about 20 minutes. Some days they're involved in some kind of Great Commission prayer. Some days they are looking at scriptures related to the Great Commission. Sometimes they may write a merchant and just express appreciation. On three or four of the days, they actually walk in the community and walk by homes and pray for them. They actually get on their feet. That 30 days, not a silver bullet, but it has done tremendous amount of work to get the church's culture looking beyond itself. Most church members are spiritual navel gazers. We're always looking inside. This was an exercise of 30 days that got people looking beyond themselves. And that's why we call it the Hope Initiative. When you begin to look at the early church was birthed out of the gospel, out of people becoming followers of Christ, and then certainly discipleship and ministry and fellowship and worship took place. And then what else took place? They started reaching more people with the gospel. So that little experiment that we've done has resulted in our admonition, confirmation, and enthusiasm that moving people slightly to look beyond themselves can make a big cultural difference, a big Great Commission difference. So that's at Church Answers. That's going to be our leading initiative for the weeks, months, and probably years to come. And I love the name of it. I don't know who decided it. I don't think it was me. The Hope Initiative.
You got a hope theme in your life, don't you, Tom?
I do. I guess so.
Okay, let's, Sam, I want to shift to this book on the rise of the neighboring church or the neighborhood church. The way that I first read about it was that there's a decline in church. It's typically mega churches, but you're seeing not new, but a renewed rise of the neighborhood church. Talk us through what you're seeing, what's inspiring.
Yeah, I wrote the book knowing that this was a movement that should be. It is not predictive of what will be. The median church size has declined over the last 20 or 30 years from 130 to about 65. So we're most churches are half the size that they were 20, 30 years ago. Whether that be a large church or a small church, churches in general are declining. So I wrote this as a way to help neighborhood churches make a comeback. And so the name of the book is The Surprising Return of the Neighborhood Church. It's a pathway. It's a strategy for helping your church get back to a place of health, particularly the neighborhood church. Now, I think there's a lot of principles in there that any church could apply, but my focus is on these churches that are on every street corner. I have heard people I've heard people talk very negatively about communities that have churches on every street corner. Like, oh, they've got a church on every street corner. And I'm thinking, why is that a bad thing? Why are we saying that's bad? That's good. Those are kingdom outposts. Now, I guess people, what they mean is those churches aren't doing what they should be doing. But I, rather than bemoan the fact that they're there, I said, okay, let's help them get back to a place of health. And I'm very excited about what could be. I'm definitely not predicting this will be, because if you sent every neighborhood church in the United States an extra 50 or 100 people, they would not know what to do with them right now. But I do believe that with several cultural factors like work from home, this boutique and local movement, shop local, this desire to make an impact in your immediate community. I mean, these are things that are important to millennials, Gen Z, you know, Gen Xers. And I think that that regional church model of, hey, we're going to drive 45 minutes to church is over with. And more and more people are looking in their local communities for things, not just church, but just about everything. And I think that if we get to work now, over the course of the next 20 years, you can see an incredible movement of neighborhood churches, and it excites me.
Okay, hard question. I don't know, maybe it'll be easy for you. Maybe we'll delete this one because you don't want it aired. But what I'm seeing, and this is just anecdotal, you guys have the numbers and you have your own opinions on things. But there are a lot of empty church buildings on the street corners of the communities that I'm in regularly that you said, I think rightfully, they wouldn't know what to do with an extra 50 people. It's not part of their mission. Their mission for a long time has been keeping the establishment happy. And it's got them to a place where their building's empty and their entire neighborhood knows they're irrelevant. Does that also have to do with the fact that we have an aging pastor problem? Are people, and I don't think it's an age thing. I think it's an, I lost my mojo, I lost my passion thing more than anything. Do we have people who are overstaying their passion or their call? And is that part of why we have such a precipitous decline from median of 130 to a median of 60?
Well, I guess it would be the case of some, but I don't think that's, you know, have I overstayed my welcome? I'm sure you could point to cases where that's true, but I don't think that's the driving factor at all. I think you can be a pretty awesome pastor at 70 or 75. It's not an overstaying your welcome thing. I think it's a loss of a desire to think outward that's really the problem here. And that's not just on the pastor, that's also on the people. I'll say this, evangelism will never die in your church if you do it. So, and you can take two and three people and really do some incredible work. So this isn't something that even takes, you know, a mass of people to accomplish. If you take five people in a church and they all go get two or three families a year, that's just what they do. They just say, okay, there's five of us. Let's go get two or three families a year. Well, I mean, your church is the median church size in like a year or two, you know, and then you're well over 100 and then 200 and 300. So, you know, I just think it takes a handful of people in a church to really build that momentum again.
All right, Tom. So, the second half of that question then goes to you. Are you seeing any correlation between people who have sort of lost their passion and drive in ministry and the decline of the church, particularly church leaders? It doesn't have to be just lead pastors, but people in decision-making, leadership positions, preaching positions.
Any church leader, pastor, ranging from the age of 21 to 81, who has lost their passion for the Great Commission will see a church that has lost its passion to reach people and thus will be in decline. Age is not the factor. Not even necessarily training is the factor. It is just a desire to see the Great Commission fulfilled. And as Sam indicated, and what we have indicated with the Hope Initiative, it can be you and one other person, and that, and you being the pastor or the person there. So I think the enemy is doing a very good job of convincing us that there are too many good things to do the great things. So it's a sin to be good when God has called us to be great. And we are not engaging in the Great Commission nearly in any way close to the way the Bible indicates from Acts 2 to Revelation 3 that churches should be. And so to me, that is the great missing part of the church today, but it's also one of the simplest, I didn't say easiest, but also one of the simplest to return to the church as well.
Ah, that's well said. Amen to that. Tom, thanks for everything. Where's the best place to find Church Answers? Is it just hit the website up?
Yeah, churchanswers.com would be the best site. And I did also mention, and I'll put this there for you, Hope Initiative, hopeinitiative.com. That's about to become a reality. So I'm not sure when this will be released, but hopeinitiative.com and churchanswers.com.
Awesome. We'll make sure we get links to those in the show notes for our listeners. Tom and Sam, we're grateful to have you on the podcast. Thank you for what you guys are doing to put wind in the sails of local church leaders, to bring data and analytics and a pastor's heart alongside those leaders across the country. That's great work. We're privileged to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks, Sean.
What a great episode. Leaders, have you ever felt like leadership is lonely? Have you ever felt like what is demanded of you to succeed in ministry is more than you've got? I would love for you to consider getting in a cohort with us. What we do is we pour into leaders to make leadership not lonely, but also to equip you with how to meet the challenges that ministry and leadership have. If you're a transitions leader, a new leader transitioning into a church, we've got a cohort for you. If you're a church planter, anywhere from -1 to +5 in planting, we've got a cohort for you. And if you're an executive pastor leader in a church, we've got a cohort for you. Hit us up, theascentleader.org. Until next time, lead well. Thanks and take care. Wow. Leaders, thank you so much for tuning in. We are just blown away by all the things that you guys tell us that this is doing to grow you and develop you. And I'll tell you what, if you feel like this is growing you as a leader, as a person, as a pastor, we would be honored if not only would you continue to listen, but if you would subscribe, if you would get on social and say something so that the people you have influence over can see the ways that this is benefiting you and that they would check us out as well. That would mean the world to us. Thank you so much for listening.